Hi, I'm Ivan Semenek. Welcome to The Universe in Mind. This is episode 2 of a special podcast about Galileo and his incredible discoveries with the telescope. Discoveries that first appeared in print 400 years ago this year. Our guide and interpreter is Mario Biagioli. He's an historian of science and a professor at Harvard University, and author of 2 books about Galileo, Galileo's Instruments of Credit and Galileo Courtier, The Practice of Science in the Culture of Absolutism. In part 1, Dr. Biagioli explained how the telescope wasn't just a scientific instrument for Galileo, but an instrument of social advancement, scoring him an influential new career with the Medici, the ruling family of Florence. Now we come to the events Galileo is best known for, his conflict with the church, culminating in his trial in 1633. This has often been portrayed as the ultimate showdown between scientific truth and religious dogma. But the real story is more complicated, and it has as much to do with political calculations as it does with mathematics or astronomy. Mario Biagioli picks up the tale in the summer of 1610, as Galileo takes his place in the court of his new employer, the Grand Duke of Florence. For Galileo, it's a chance to try out a new identity. No longer just a lowly professor, he's now an intellectual superstar.
So, first of all, a key resource that he obtained in Florence wasn't just a much nicer salary and more time to do work, but he also obtained the title of philosopher. So he was philosopher and mathematician of the Grand Duke.
Galileo's new status as a philosopher was key. In today's academic universe, a mathematician would have no reason to feel professionally inferior to a philosopher. In Renaissance Italy, it was a different story.
And not only in Italy, but throughout Europe. And that's you have a clear sign of that if you look, for instance, at the salaries. The salaries of mathematicians in universities were usually a fraction of the salary of a philosopher. So basically, right now, in the modern university, we see almost like a reversal. The sciences are the ones, they get the money, they get the respect. Right. And instead, in many campuses, the philosophy department, usually is not the key department of the university. And instead, in 1600, it was pretty much the opposite.
In order to teach mathematics in Galileo's time, you didn't need a degree, and Galileo didn't have one. In fact, arithmetic and geometry were simply seen as tools for surveying the land, or bookkeeping, or drawing plans, or computing the positions of planets. All practical stuff. In contrast, philosophers had their minds turned towards higher questions.
So it wasn't just the status, the social status, but was the fact that philosophers were seen as the people who could actually talk about the physical aspects of natural phenomena, as well as about the causes. So mathematicians were supposed to describe. So mathematicians were supposed to come up with geometrical models of planetary motions, and that was pretty much it. So the fact that Galileo makes claims about the physical nature of, say, the moon, basically he's a mathematician who talks like a philosopher.
For Galileo, talking like a philosopher meant he had the freedom and the platform to express his opinions on the physical realities behind the mathematics. And that included his opinions on the solar system. For years, Galileo had been persuaded by the ideas of Nicholas Copernicus, who lived a century before. Copernicus proposed that the Earth is not at the center of the solar system, as Aristotle imagined. Instead, he realized that certain astronomical motions made more sense if the Sun were at the center, with the Earth and the planets circling around. Galileo was persuaded, and he hoped to use his telescopic discoveries to press the case in favor of Copernicus. However, it was a risky business. If Copernicus was right, then Earth was in motion, which contradicts a literal reading of the Bible. That's why the Sidereus Nuncius, the book Galileo wrote about his telescopic observations and dedicated to the Medici, largely steers clear of Copernicus.
If you read the Sidereus Nuncius without any preconception about who Galileo is and the fact that he's a Copernican and so on, you'll see that there are actually very, 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 very few references to the Copernican system. So it does not look like Galileo wants to make a big statement about Copernicus in the Sidereus Nuncius at all, which confirms that at the point, although he was a Copernican, his main goal was to make a big splash.
Right.
Not necessarily to upset the Aristotelian philosopher, and certainly not to upset the theologians. I mean, there is absolutely zero evidence that Galileo wanted to get into a dispute with the theologians.
Fortunately for Galileo, by the fall of 1610, he was not the only one looking at the night sky through a telescope. A number of Jesuit astronomers were also exploring the heavens with the new device, and they couldn't help but see what Galileo had seen.
And at the point, the Congregation of the Holy Office, the Inquisition, sends a letter to the Jesuits asking them what they think about Galileo's discoveries, and the Jesuits confirm. Now, the really interesting thing there is the Jesuits' confirmation of the phases of Venus.
As Galileo saw through his telescope, the planet Venus appeared to have a complete range of phases, going from full to a narrow crescent. Astronomers soon realized that could only be possible if Venus orbits the Sun rather than the Earth. Such an arrangement completely contradicts the ancient picture of the solar system known as the Ptolemaic system after Ptolemy.
And if you look at the diagram, you see that, you know, there is no way that, based on that model, you could observe the full range of the phases. I mean, Venus would be a little more illuminated or not, but it would not go through the phases.
Right.
So the phases of Venus is really the punchline, you know, of all the discoveries of Galileo. And by the way, the phases of Venus was not in the Sidereus Nuncius, but, you know, came up. He observed them, you know, a few months later. So technically, the phases of Venus refutes Ptolemy. So basically, at the end of 1610, the game has changed. Copernicus is not proven right yet.
Right.
There is no proof. But if you are a minimally competent astronomer, you would understand that Ptolemy is dead.
Ptolemy was dead, but there was another option. Decades earlycher, the Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe proposed another model. It kept the Earth at the center of the solar system, but had Venus and the other planets moving around the Sun, which then together circled Earth.
That's when the story, I think, becomes particularly complicated, because the options, the cosmological options, change.
Galileo was unable to provide any observations that could discriminate between the Tychonic and the Copernican options. To play it safe with church authorities, Galileo the mathematician might have sat on the fence. But Galileo the bold philosopher of Florence saw things differently.
There are a number of discoveries that, in his view, provide more evidence for Copernicus, so the sunspots. The discovery of sunspots. He published a book in 1613, and he shows that the sunspots, they emerge. So not only the sunspots are not supposed to exist because the sun is supposed to be perfect, blah, blah, blah. Instead, this is the worst kind of change, because it's not, they're not just, they're not, say, craters like the craters on the moon, that they are craters. So the moon is not perfect, but at least these things stay put. The case of sunspots is like, you know, second-order change. These things, they are on the sun, and they keep changing, right? So
right.
It's a particularly nasty kind of change for an Aristotelian to explain. But on top of that, he sees that, you know, he argues that the movement of the sunspot suggests that the sun itself turns. And he thinks that, you know, and to him, that gives evidence that, you know, the sun turns and all the other planets turn too. So in a sense, it's an additional argument for the sun being at the center. So in his view, evidence for Copernicus keeps building up.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, he's being attacked as a Copernican. And so he has to defend himself. So the fact that he becomes more and more of an ardent Copernican is a combination of additional evidence, but also the fact that his adversaries are turning him into, you know, if you want, they're basically getting him out of the Copernican closet, so to speak.
Galileo's keen sense of political realities had won him a favored position with the Grand Duke. But now, court politics was catching up with him, and his Achilles heel was Copernicus.
Again, it's not Galileo that makes a big statement about, I'm a Copernican, Copernican is right. It's more that Copernicus is brought up by the people who want to attack Galileo. Hmm. And they use, you know, his Copernicanism as a liability.
Eventually, the dispute over Copernicus came to a head, with huge implications for Galileo. Once again, it was political rivalry that drove events, and it all started over dinner at court.
Galileo was not present, but his student assistant was there, Benedetto Castelli, and the Grand Duchess, actually the mother of the Grand Duke, Christina, asked Castelli, as the avatar of Galileo, you know, what about the relationship between the scriptures and Copernicus? And this was a question that was fed to her by a philosopher from the university.
By a presumably a competitor of Galileo?
Yeah, by an Aristotelian philosopher, right. I think Boscaglia from Pisa. So then this precipitated a crisis, because you can see that had the Medici come to believe that Galileo was heretic, because of the incompatibility between Copernicus and the scripture, most likely he would have lost his job.
To counter this threat, Galileo embarked on a letter-writing campaign, both to Castelli and the Grand Duchess. But it's clear he had a larger audience in mind.
A great deal of the work that Galileo did, so for instance, the letter to Castelli and then the letter to the Grand Duchess Christina, it could be seen both as a discussion with theologians trying to argue that really there is no conflict between Copernicus and the scripture. So you have this kind of, if you want, highbrow discussion with the theologian. But it's also a text that it's aimed at pacifying, you know, the Medicis. Right? So there you see a tension between being a Copernican and being a courtier in Italy.
Right.
Because most likely, if Galileo was even in France, where although it's a Catholic country, but they had a different relationship with the Pope, probably he would not have run into those problems. So, but a courtier in Catholic Italy, in the state that is just north of the Papal States, that's a tricky, right, you know, space to occupy.
So, did it work? Did it mollify the Medici's concern?
I think it did, at least for the time being. But it's also interesting that the argument there that Galileo developed in the book was not to say that Copernicus was right. He basically used in a very tongue-in-cheek way the fact that the Jesuit had confirmed that Ptolemy was wrong, and therefore that the theologians could no longer assume that they ought to read the Bible in a geocentric manner. Right? So basically he's trying to say, you know, I'm not saying that I'm right, but I can show you, and actually the Jesuits have already told you, that, you know, maybe you cannot hold on to your current reading of the Bible. So it was almost like a truce that he was trying to strike.
Galileo's attempt at a truce failed utterly. In 1616, the church condemned Copernicus, leading to a rather delicate conversation between Galileo and the Inquisition.
So the condemnation of 1616 does not involve Galileo directly, or at least the text of the condemnation does not mention Galileo, but Galileo is called in and is told that he cannot defend Copernicanism as a true physical model. So that changes the options. So at the point, the Jesuits effectively become Tychonics, because although they have been very sympathetic to Galileo's work, at the point they realize that Copernicus is out for them, so they have to become Tychonic. So in a sense, Galileo is more isolated.
For Galileo, this isolation meant 16 years of keeping a low profile on the subject of Copernicus. But as time went on, personalities in Rome changed, and a friend of Galileo's even became Pope. This may have emboldened Galileo to speak his mind once again, and he did. In 1632, Galileo published his Dialogue on the Two World Systems, a treatise that presented different views on the solar system. That much was fine by the church. What was not fine was the way Galileo made the Copernican view seem far superior. Worse still, Galileo appeared to ridicule the Pope, using some of his own words in a mocking way. Within a year, Galileo was back before the Inquisition, this time accused of heresy.
And then there is the very intricate story of the trial that, you know, I think we know most of it, but not all of it. And, you know, it, to a large extent, is a story of a series of misunderstanding. That is, that Galileo thinks that actually he has been authorized to make a certain kind of claims. That is, that the Cold War with the theologians, had kind of softened up as a result of the new Pope, Urban VIII. But there are a series of misunderstandings on both sides. I mean, it has been cast as the usual kind of science versus religion clash, but it's a much murkier story, but it's a very long story.
Right. Galileo was often portrayed in a heroic light, you know, as a kind of defender of reason against the forces of superstition, or more specifically against the church. Is he a heroic figure to you?
I would say no. I think it's an extremely interesting figure, but heroic is not the adjective I would use. And the reason why it's very difficult to answer the question is because so much has become invested in the trial. So on one side you have, if you want the kind of the lay community who likes to see Galileo as the martyr of of science persecuted by the church. And then you have, on the other side, you have the Catholics who try to say, well, look, actually, it was a really big misunderstanding. You know, this was not supposed to happen, blah, blah, blah. So the trial has become this kind of emblematic event that, of course, was not. So it's very hard to really separate the history from the later investments in this episode. So no, I wouldn't say that, I don't think that Galileo was a hero. I think that Galileo made certain bets that I think were quite courageous. But also you can see that sometimes probably he made the wrong bets, or the circumstances changed as he was launching for the last push to get the dialogue on the two chief world system out. You know, some of his strong supporters died. So, in a sense, he had less support than he had early on. So I wouldn't say that Galileo was just blinded by his ego and he just went ahead knowing that he would be, slaughtered. That's not the case at all. He made some reasonable bet on the risky side and it didn't pan out.
Now, we started by talking about Galileo in the context of his time. How much of this was a matter of discussion and interest in his time? I mean, from our point of view, Galileo was the most interesting thing happening in 1609 or 1610, and of course later on during the years of his trial. For us, they would have been headline news around the world. Was it headline news back then? Was it something that was under discussion in a large circle of people?
It was. I think the news of Galileo's trial spread also because they were spread by the church to basically warn the mathematical community. The various local inquisitors summoned the local mathematicians and read them a report of what had happened to Galileo. So there was that kind of media push by the church itself. And then we know from major authors such as Descartes, that Descartes mentions that he basically changed his publication plans because, to his surprise, he heard that the church had condemned Galileo. So clearly, the condemnation had an impact, and that it had the very direct effect of turning pretty much all Catholic astronomers toward Tycho. Whether they really became sincere Tychonic or they just went through the motion and pretended that they were Tychonic, it's hard to tell. But officially, Tycho became the cosmological model to be used by astronomy. But in the, for instance, in England, if you fast forward toward the second half of the 17th century, so discussions between Hooke, Newton, and other people about the structure of the cosmos, everybody just assumes that Copernicus is right. Basically, they have, at the Royal Society, they had a bet about the first one who would derive Kepler's laws from physical principle. I see no sense of any theological anxiety, you know, about that at all. So the impact is very much on Catholic countries, and even there, I would say mostly Italy and you know, and probably Spain.
So Galileo may have not intended exactly what happened, but do you think he deserves the credit he has today as essentially a kind of handmaiden of the scientific revolution, some kind of a major turning point in human perception of the universe?
Having written, you know, two books on Galileo and continuing to work on him, I find him the most interesting figure in the scientific revolution, precisely because of this blend of, you know, brilliance, you know, great mathematician, but also very, very, very good with his hands, and, you know, very savvy, funny, sarcastic. I am completely biased in favor of Galileo. And clearly he was seen as a central player in his time, right? You know, and that's also something that you see in the later 17th century, especially his work on mechanics is referred to a lot. So he's an extremely interesting figure and crucial to the scientific revolution. What I want to say is that the trial has become more important now than it was in 1633. And in a sense, you know, Galileo is so much attached to the trial when actually the trial was really an extremely unfortunate end to his scientific life. But I think, most of the interesting things he did actually did not have to do with the trial.
So how did his status, you know, how did his relationship with the Medici end?
With the exception of that glitch around 1613, with the discussion between the, you know, the Grand Duchess and Castelli over, you know, the relationship between Copernicus and the scripture, and by the way, that was a glitch that was contained. The Medici remained extremely supportive of Galileo. So, for instance, if you read the correspondence between Rome and Florence during the trial, the Medici really instructed their ambassador to go and talk to the Pope and plea Galileo's case. And to the point that the Pope actually got mad and basically threatened the Grand Duke. There is a line in one of this letter, you know, the Pope telling the ambassador, you know, tell the Grand Duke to stay out of this, because he's not going to come out of this looking good. He should worry about, not basically not supporting heretics. Hmm. So you can see that the Grand Duke really pushed, which is actually kind of interesting, because based on the behavior of patrons, I would not have expected that.
So was it a face-saving thing for the Duke, or was the Grand Duke exhibiting some genuine affection for Galileo as a person?
So this was not the Grand Duke who was in power in 1610 when Galileo made the telescopic discoveries. This was his son. But you can see that there is a great deal of respect, because they did go out the extra mile, you know, surprisingly so. And even after Galileo's death, the Medici tried to build a mausoleum in Florence, which was stopped by the Pope. And so it happened only in 1734, a few popes afterwards. So they did support him pretty much till the end. Not to mention that they could have easily cut his salary.
But they didn't. So
they didn't.
And they kept him going right to the very end.
You know, despite the fact that his salary was technically coming out of the budget of the University of Pisa, though he was never teaching there. And the people at Pisa made a case to the Grand Duke saying that this was unacceptable. and basically the Grand Duke overruled them. So not only he did not cut his salary, but he actually defended his salary.
So some of that courtly behavior paid off.
It did. But I would say that toward the end, I think it's more like it looks like he had gained enough credit, because it's not that he was doing a lot of work that the court would have appreciated. He was pretty much toward the end of his career. But still, they must have liked him.
You've been listening to part two of an all Galileo edition of The Universe in Mind. Remember, you can subscribe to our show on iTunes. The Universe in Mind is sponsored by the Dunlap Institute for Astronomy and Astrophysics, and it's produced here at the University of Toronto. Johannes Hearn is associate producer, with online support from Kathy Parrott. Our cover art is by Bettina Forget. I'm Ivan Semenik. Join us again soon for more excursions into the realm of astronomical ideas. And in the meantime, don't forget to keep the universe in mind.